You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2024 Vuelta a España from Lisboa to Madrid.
Buenas tardes, Fran Cartel Reyes, in your home region, Andalucía. Not really in that your home region of your home region, is it?
No, it's Sevilla, especially when I was a child, I perceived it as a very distant capital from which the evil came. But now I'm getting more dear to it thanks to music.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because there is amazing music here in Sevilla. It's the hotbed of
modern
flamenco
music. Yeah, I was going to say, so the city of Carmen, the opera, city of the Barber of Seville, another opera, Rossini opera, city of flamenco, city of El Gran Derby. Mm-hmm. I think the football derby between Betis and Sevilla, about which there are fascinating stories. I was reading up about that today, Fran, and quite unlike a lot of other big football rivalries in other cities, there's this great history of each team sending each other into the second division in Spain. And well, we won't go into that in too much depth today, but a very alluring city.
Yeah, and also one thing that I like a lot about the Betis-Sevilla rivalry is that, especially in the recent years, has not been that violent. You know,
no.
Because yeah, usually
good humor.
Yeah, I mean, relatively, they just like each other. And after all, it's the same city. They usually are workmates and such. Mm. So those violent spats, back in the day when the presidents of each club were opposite to each other and they were insulting each other on TV and on dinners, it was a bit more heated. But right now, it's respectful, and you can say that it's really a party, the derby, and not a tense sports match that can get angry.
Do you have sympathies with Sevilla or Betis?
Betis. Okay. Betis rather than Sevilla.
They have a wonderful colours, of course, Betis. Green
the
and
Andalucía,
white.
The Andalucía colours.
Exactly, yeah. Fran, I was also going to possibly... dip into the very sort of murky water. Well, we're looking out over the river at the moment. I think this is strictly speaking, this is the canal, not the actual river.
Yeah, I think so. But it is the Guadalquivir. It is like the Seine for Paris, yet a bit less deadly. I mean, people still choke to death in this river, but at least they don't get sick if they swim in the water, so it's good.
So I was going to mention murky waters, because that's one side of us, Fran. We're looking out over the river, and what a beautiful view it is. One of my colleagues told me earlier that the other side of the river is very gentrified and very nice, and there are lots of beautiful flamenco bars over there. Right behind us is the Plaza de Toros, the bullfighting arena, and it's the biggest in Spain, if I'm not mistaken. I think probably the most famous as well.
Exactly.
A very controversial subject, bullfighting, of course, in Spain. Fran, I was reading about your home city, Almería, and the groups that exist in Almería and that have been protesting against bullfighting. There are some good names. Where is this? There was one, I think it was called Culture Not Torture. Cultura
y no Tortura.
No Tortura. Was one of the names of the pressure groups. But also, in recent times, Fran, as recently as this May, there's been a controversy about this bullfighting arena behind me, because one of the organisers that puts on bullfights in Sevilla, they announced that they were going to offer free entry to under 8-year-olds as a way to introduce them to
get acquainted with blood
exactly,
and torture.
To introduce them to bullfighting, and of course this met with considerable consternation, one could say outrage, even in Spain.
Yeah, if I can say, you know, about bullfighting, on one hand, it's a show that is completely updated, you know, and it's a tradition that really shouldn't live longer. And on the other hand, there is one side of it that I think that Andalucía and Spain needs to preserve, and it's the fact that there is an emanation of the toros culture back into the Spanish society and Spanish culture as a whole. I mean, I would love for it to stop happening, but still, it is embedded somehow in the identity, in the language, and I mean, even if it is a tradition that we don't fancy anymore, we have to observe it as part of what we are. If I don't know if my point comes across completely, But yeah.
Well, Fran, you're only here until stage 9, so if you get cancelled, then it doesn't matter too much anyway.
Yeah.
You'll be replaced anyway after stage 9, but I think I know what you mean. The important thing from my point of view is that you are, you recognise the sort of barbarity of it.
Of course.
Fran, we should talk about cycling. We really should talk about cycling. The listeners have probably figured out, if they didn't watch the stage today, by now at this point in the podcast, 5 minutes in, not a mention of cycling, that it wasn't the most thrilling of stages. It was certainly a very hot day yet again. And Fran, we're going to tell people what happened in just a moment, but before we do, let's go back in time to this morning and the start. It was also very hot. We were still in Extremadura this morning, and let's hear from a couple of riders. Let's hear from the rider who would start this fifth stage of the Vuelta a España in the red jersey as the race leader. And let's also hear from, so I'm talking about Primoz Roglic, of course, and let's also hear from his closest challenger on general classification, João Almeida, who started the day in second place, 8 seconds behind. How were they respectively feeling about what occurred yesterday? Is Roglic and Almeida.
Just great, yeah, like I said, really enjoyed yesterday the show of the whole team, how we were racing, yes, what we did, and yeah, really happy and proud. I mean that, after not, let's say, so good times, changed a bit, and it's always really great to win. For the moment, definitely, yes, it's working, I'm functioning good, but the fact is that I'm still not 100%, and it's hard to say, really, in which kind of direction it will go, you know, because the racing is hard day after day, so, yeah, just being relaxed, enjoy the race, try to do the best, and with the whole team every day, and we see.
Yeah, I could manage my effort quite good, so, yeah, that's a good point from yesterday. But overall, I was always pretty close, so I was pretty chill, and yeah. And in the end, I could come back to the group and sprint for the third place, so I was very happy with the outcome.
I think we never know when he's gonna have a bad day, so of course, he's always very, very consistent as well. So I think it's quite hard to crack him, but yeah, if it happens, it's gonna be good for me if I don't crack as well.
Okay, Fran, well, that set the scene for today's fifth stage. We didn't expect Almeida and Roglic to be too active today, did we? As far as going for the stage win was concerned, we expected a sprint day. Is that what we got? Let's have the tale of the etapa, shall we?
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
So Fran, stage 5, Fuente del Maestre to Sevilla, 177 kilometres, the only day of the Vuelta classified, officially classified on the race website as flat, llano, llana. No classified climbs, temperatures up to 36 degrees, it felt even hotter than that, didn't it, Fran, at times?
Yes.
6 kilometre an hour southerly winds, so nothing that was likely to split the race. As we said, Roglic started the day in red, Almeida 8 seconds behind, Mas in third, 32 seconds behind, 175 riders still in the race, not too many victims of crashes or anything like that so far. Fran, yesterday in the tail etapa, we mentioned a crash when 5 riders came down, I think on the descent of the first climb, and one of the riders who was reportedly involved in that crash, Alessandro De Marchi of Jayco Alula, told me this morning that was fake news. He actually had stomach problems yesterday, and he was back at the medical car for that reason. No injuries. I'm glad to say, I'm pretty sure that Alessandro got through today's stage okay. Issues for Sudal Quickstep as well at the start, Fran, because their bus was out of action. They rocked up at the start with another team's, or in another team's bus, and that team is not at the Vuelta a España. Burgos Biache, who were not invited to this year's Vuelta, but their bus is here for a day because Sudal Quickstep, well, they were looking for a replacement bus. Someone made a phone call and the bus was driven down from Burgos yesterday, I think.
Yeah, and it's great news because that way the owner of the team, Julio Andrés Izquierdo, got to see Mikel Landa descending from his team's bus. And it's great. And at the same time, they are taking part on another race in the Tibet region in China. The Trans-Himalaya Cycling Race, oh, wow. UCI.2.2.
Presumably they don't have a bus there.
No, I guess not. I guess they don't need it.
The racing got underway and a very familiar figure in this Vuelta a España, Ibon Ruiz and Chomin Juaristi of Euskaltel. Am I getting that right, Fran?
Or Euskaltel.
Euskaltel. But
Don't worry, it will get better. Huh?
It's the order between that I'm straight. It's the Euskaltel comes first. Doesn't it?
Yeah, Euskaltel, Euskadi.
Yeah. Attacked from the gun, and they had a 1 minute lead after just 5 kilometers of racing. That lead would reach nearly 6 minutes after 25 kilometers. Speed was steady, but certainly not red hot, not as red hot as the temperatures. Around 37 kilometers now for much of the stage. 50 kilometers to go, the gap was down to around about 2 minutes. Alpecin and Visma. Lisa Bike had been doing most of the pulling for their respective sprinters, Wout van Aert and Caden Groves. 43 kilometres to go, there was a sudden acceleration as the road started climbing slightly. One of the very few unclassified rises on today's stage. And shortly thereafter, in fact, at 38 kilometres to go, it would be all back together. The two breakaway riders were caught. 25 kilometres to go, we had an intermediate sprint where Caden Groves and Wout van Aert continue their private battle, and Groves got the better of van Aert. The pace continued to quicken. GC teams were now grouping at the front of the peloton with about 10 kilometres to go. We saw Red Bull up there, EF Education first, who have been very prominent at the front of the bunch on every one of these sprint days, in spite of the fact that their leader, Richard Carapaz, struggled a little bit yesterday. Maybe we'll hear a bit more about that later. I said EF were close to the business end of affairs. Well, unfortunately for them, as they rounded a left-hand bend, wasn't it, Fran, on the way into Sevilla at approximately 10 kilometres ago, Owain Doull hit some kind of crack in the road surface, in the tarmac. He came down and behind him, his teammate, the Portuguese champion, Rui Costa, also came down. Now, Doull had some sort of grazing up one side. Costa initially didn't look to be as badly off. However, he was sort of getting up quite gingerly, and we saw him in conversation with his team director, Sportif. And then very quickly, within 3 or 4 minutes, it was announced that he had abandoned the race.
Yeah, and it was puzzling to me. And, you know, it's he told me, Rui, that his crash at the Volta al Algarve earlier in the year, it was the first time that he had ever fractured a bone while racing. I guess that if he pulled out that suddenly today, he probably has feel or at least fears that has something broken that would make 2 injuries in just 1 year for a rider who had gone for 15 or 17 years as a pro with no harm.
I was also hoping to catch up with Owain Doull when he did duly finish the stage. However, he got to the finish line and did a U-turn and headed back to his team bus. So I wasn't able to catch up with him, but I think he'll probably be okay just based on what I saw of the crash and him riding afterwards. Fran, Mikel Landa had a puncture with 2 kilometres to go. You're going to tell us in a minute whether any GC leaders lost any time, but I don't think anyone did because that was well inside the buffer zone, 3 kilometre buffer zone today. It was Alpecin De Koenig who led out the sprint for Caden Groves. However, on his left, or initially behind him and then up his left side, came Wout van Aert with, on his wheel, Pavel Bittner of DSM Firmenich Post NL. And it was those two who would duke it out for the stage win, and it was very close as they came over the line. In fact, I was standing beyond the finish line. Wout van Aert initially thought he'd got it, or was told that he had got it. However, then within 30 seconds or so, it became clear that the two riders, Bittner and van Aert, were both respectively waiting to hear the official verdict. And I was standing next to van Aert. What I heard from van Aert was unbroadcastable, probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I mean, it was understandable reaction in the circumstances. Yeah. And what I heard from about 20 metres away, where Bittner was surrounded by his teammates, was a cry of jubilation and ecstasy because the young Czech rider had claimed his first Grand Tour stage victory. Third was Caden Groves. Fourth was the lesser-sighted Brian Coquart. Stefan Kung in fifth place, which is not something that would have predicted. Corbin Strong sixth, Jonathan Narváez in seventh, Arne Marit eighth, Gianmarco Garofoli in ninth, and Jesus Soto of Kern Pharma in tenth.
Yeah, it's a top 10 that says a lot about the level of the sprinters field in this world, doesn't it?
Indeed. Fran, you're going to update us on the various classifications.
Well, there is not much to update as far as the GC is concerned. Roglic keeps the lead with 8 seconds on Almeida, 32 seconds on Enric Mas. And then, rounding out the top 10, we have Tiberi, Van Etveld, Gaul, McNulty, Skilmose, Landa, and Blasov, who is at 1 minute exactly from his leader and teammate. In the points, Jersey, Wout van Aert keeps the lead by 13 points on Caden Groves. KOM classification, no news whatsoever as there were no classified climbs. Sylvain Moniquet from Lotto Destiny is still with 16 points and in the lead by 5 on Filippo Zana. And in the youth classification, it's Antonio Tiberi from Bahrain Victorious wearing the white jersey.
Fran, I propose that we hear from, in chronological order, in the order in which they sort of did their jobs. Let's hear from one of the DSM lead out train first, Julius Vandenberg. Then we're going to hear from Pavel Bittner, the stage winner. And then we will hear from Wout van Aert, who, although he didn't take the stage, as you just said, is still wearing the points jersey tonight.
Surprise. We knew he was fast. In Burgos, he takes 2 stages, and I think there were also some good sprinters there. So, for sure, it's not a really big surprise, but it's really nice to see him win here. I think we did a really good job with the whole team. We have a really nice team, good atmosphere. Everybody wants to be involved in the sprint train. So, it's really, really nice to have this victory.
One of those days where everyone knows it's going to be a sprint, and it didn't even seem, I mean, you can tell me if it was, but it didn't seem that fast with 4 or 5 kilometres to go. Just talk me in from about 3 kilometres to go, what it felt like.
Yeah, to be honest, you notice that there are some less sprinter teams here. On a flat finish like this, we showed we have the horsepower, and I don't think a lot of teams have the horsepower like we do. So we managed to be in the front the whole time, and that worked out perfectly.
Apart from Watts, what is his great strength as a sprinter? Apart from power, what's his great strength?
No, I think his speed. You see, on a flat finish like this, he's the fastest guy here, I think, and he can ride over hills as well. So I think he's a strong guy, and we hear a lot more about him.
We actually had our own train. We were just focusing on doing our own sprint. And in the final, Alpecin used us a bit, and he was just drag racing next to them, which helped me save a lot of energy. And then I just found a good wheel and opened my sprint. So it was really, really nice. Yeah, I think the advantage was just the whole teamwork. I think there was not so many teams that did such a good work for their sprinters. So I think it just goes to show that we are capable of doing that. And it's just super cool to do it together with the whole team and not just by myself.
I don't think I launched too early. I mean, I went really early, but it was on high speed, so then it's always hard to catch up. I think I did my bike throw too early. With the shadow part, like 50 meters to go, I was confused, I guess. And when I was already stopped pedaling, and then I realized the line was still quite a bit further, so I did another pedal stroke. And yeah, then I was only I don't know, 10 centimeters behind. So yeah, that might have been the difference.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
The Cycling Podcast is very proud to be partners with MAP, the clothing company that was created in Melbourne and then exported to the world with the spirit and ethos and energy and excitement of that great Aussie city, almost enmeshed into the fabric, so to speak. I'm certainly very proud to wear my MAP clothing when I'm out on the bike doing my thing on the roads of not Watford here. And I see a lot more MAP jerseys out there on the roads than I ever used to, that's for sure. Anyway, you might like to check out map.cc, their website, because they've got a series focusing on their sponsored riders, or privateers as they call them. And these are riders who are really channeling the spirit of road cycling's pioneers, those riders who in the early days set their own agenda, pursued their own goals, and did their own thing their own way before the advent of organized teams. One of the stories is an inspirational one, really, a story of recovery, that of the Dutch rider Ivar Slik, who was the 2022 Unbound winner and who also won the Tracker 200 in Girona. His season was derailed after being hit by a car, and he was taken to a hospital where doctors found he had a bleed on the brain. And while he was recovering from that, it was also discovered that his meniscus was in the wrong place, so he had to have surgery for that, setting him back a little bit further. Well, now he's on the comeback trail and looking ahead to next year's racing, and he says he wants to win Unbound again. And as if to prove just how quickly the gravel scene is evolving and growing up, he wants to employ a domestique next season, a support rider who isn't necessarily there to assist strategically or tactically, but could be a massive advantage in the event of a puncture by giving their wheel, of course. Now, that just says to me how quickly gravel racing is growing and almost mirroring the evolution of road cycling, what, a century and a bit ago. Anyway, you can read the full series with Map's privateers at map.cc and check out the range of clothing, each design inspired by one of those riders.
Daniel Freber from the Cycling Podcast. How rewarding and satisfying is it to see that someone who you chose for the Encuentro del Día has won the stage?
Yeah, it is quite satisfying, but it happens quite a lot. We should be able to, you know...
Yeah. To foresee what the race is going to be.
Not to predict the future. But yeah, you always do feel quite smug when this happens, particularly, you know, when you're working when I've got my other sort of hat on, when I'm doing TV work, and you pick out a bit of a wild card in the morning. You say to your director, I think we should interview that guy, and then he goes on to win. But more often, the opposite happens.
Yeah.
You speak very convincingly. Well, you make a very convincing argument to your director that, you know, we should have so-and-so in the programme, and so-and-so proceeds to, well, disappoint for him. That has happened more often.
But you can still take some pride, yes, you know? You got the underdog,
well,
and
good.
He won.
Well, what is interesting, I mean, a rider like Bittner, and we'll give a bit more background information shortly, he's a very unfamiliar name. And in terms of, well, his success and people realising that he was going to be a factor in this Vuelta a España, it's all happened incredibly quickly, in the sense that before the Vuelta a Burgos a couple of weeks ago, I don't think anyone outside Czech Republic, we're going to come back onto the thorny issue of Czechia versus Czech Republic in a minute, but I don't think too many people knew very much at all. And in the press conference this evening or this afternoon, rather than the usual questions about how you executed the sprint, we got a lot of questions along the lines of, can you just tell us something about where you come from?
Background questions.
Yeah, just eking out those biographical details and trying to sort of fit pieces of a puzzle together. And we will continue to do that, Fran, in just a minute. We'll give a few more details about Pavel Bittner. I'm quite disappointed, Fran, that when was it? A couple of days ago, you got quite excited about the sort of puns that were being suggested for. It was the day when it was extremely hot. It was 2 days ago in Portugal, wasn't it? In Castelo Branco, and you got quite excited about this. I thought the official Vuelta, the press office, made a decent fist of today, because we got a bittersweet, didn't we?
Bittersweet. It is great.
Yeah.
It is great. Yeah. I love this kind of headlines. I would like to be able to come up with one of those every day, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So on to Pavel Bittner. Should we talk about the sprint first, and then again return to trying to acquaint the listeners with who this guy is, what he's done, and where he might be going in the future? So the sprint itself, Fran.
So it was a very beautiful sprint from the point of view that you saw some interesting tactic for Wout van Aert. He launched quite early, because he was looking to try and surprise somehow the rest and take advantage also of his capacity to keep up a great pace and a great power for a long section of road. He chose the right side of the road as well as he was approaching.
Side. Oh, the right side, the left side as he was looking at it.
Yes. So that's true. So he chose the side on which everyone was preparing the sprint because it was the one that was a bit more sheltered from the slight wind. And by doing this, he apparently closed the door for those who were on his wheel. Yet Bittner, who couldn't really overtake him until last 50 meters of the sprint, he was very good at temporizing his effort, you know, at choosing when to make that final effort. And indeed, he only won by a very tiny margin. I mean, it was less than 20 centimeters. And that tells you about how timely his sprint was. Mm. And that also says a lot about how Van Aert was good at choosing his strategy, because he nearly got away with victory with a very long and powerful sprint.
Yeah, Fran, it was one of those days when it was very obvious that it was going to be a bunch sprint, and these are often very nervous days. You often see crashes on days like this. Today, the roads coming to Sevilla were so wide, with the exception of that, well, I talked about it earlier, the sort of crack in the road surface or pothole or whatever it was that took out Owain Doull and Rui Costa. There weren't too many technical sections of that finale, but what that often means is that you see sprinters and lead out trains get their timing wrong because they've been waiting for this moment for hours and hours and hours, and you often see them get quite impetuous. Today there was another sort of another thing to consider in the finale, and that was a bit of a tailwind, is what we can feel it now. In fact, we can feel the breeze sort of going down the river in the same way that it was going an hour or two ago. I guess that helped Van Aert to open his sprint up slightly earlier.
Very good point.
And that doesn't really take anything away from, well, Bittner either, and his speed to be able to come off Wout Van Aert's wheel. He obviously had a lot of power, a lot of speed, and as you said, also excellent timing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, after all, we have to take into account as well, as we were saying earlier when we were reading the names in the top 10, that the field is not great. That means that the possibility of finding someone faster than Van Aert over a 250 meter sprint is not that big, you know. We found only Bittner today, but Groves was slightly slower than I expected, to be honest, because I thought that in this kind of finale he would be at least on par with Van Aert, and as for the rest, no one can come close. So it is a competition on which Van Aert can comfortably sprint and be confident that he can get away with the win.
Yes. Fran, back to the issue of Pavel Bittner's nationality, because I think before we even knew that we would be talking much about Pavel Bittner in this Vuelta a España, we were talking about another rider, Vatek, after the time trial on Saturday. I mentioned the fact that, well, Czech Republic, well, the country formerly known as Czech Republic, now likes to be referred to as Czechia. We had a message, an email from a Czech listener, who identified himself as Misha. He said, please keep referring to the Czech Republic as the Czech Republic. Us Czech people find the term Czechia outrageous. Doesn't sound right by any means. It was pushed by our pro-Russian ex-president. Everybody else hates it. No one can relate to it. And we will all keep using the name Czech Republic whenever we can. Nothing is going to change that. I'd say it's close to a dictator in Swaziland renaming their country to Eswatini, so it no more sounds like Switzerland.
You know, I was wondering if the Czech Republic was getting prepared to become a monarchy somehow. You know, maybe they are jealous of to see the monarchy that we have in Spain, that essentially does not a whole lot for the country.
Mm. A little bit more sort of trivia biographical information about Bittner, which was revealed by Bittner himself in the press conference. Fran, he's a Hispano hablante. He speaks a bit of, well, he certainly understood Spanish. I actually think that Primoz Roglic, he understood a question in Spanish today, quite a sort of long and complex question, and he didn't seem to require any translation. Of course, he replied in English, but I don't know, I have to check that. But that struck me as curious. However, Bittner definitely speaks and understands some Spanish. Why? Well, he explained in the press conference today that there was a time, I'm just bringing up my notes here, during his education, he had a period of 2 years where he was doing 10 hours of Spanish a week. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but he recently, I presume he rented, and didn't buy, a flat in Calpe. On the Costa, it's the Costa Blanca, isn't it?
Yeah, he used the word buy, but I was surprised as well, you know, that after 5 years in the World Tour with not a big salary, he was able to actually buy himself an apartment.
21-year-old property magnate Pavel Bittner. Talking of Czech magnates, I was hearing the other day about, well, Roman Kreuziger, I think it was well known at the time because we talked about him the other day as an illustrious former Czech rider of recent years. I think it was well known at the time that he came from a wealthy family. Someone was explaining to me the other day that his father, who was also a cyclist himself and was also called Roman, I believe, so Roman Kreuziger Sr., in retirement became a service station, a gas station magnate in Czech Republic. And, well, it was said to me, it was put to me that at one point he owned every service station in Czech Republic. I don't believe that's true.
Well,
he owned a lot of them.
If that's the case, rather than a magnate, he is a king or an emperor. So we can say that he was Roman emperor, wasn't it?
Oh, very good. Very good. Excellent. Fran, talking of Rome and all things Roman, we stayed in Mérida last night, which is a city in Extremadura with a lot of Roman remains, monuments, a Roman theatre, Roman temple. Certainly somewhere I would recommend people visit if they find themselves in the west of Spain. Fran, I propose that now we turn our thoughts to the general classification in the absence of too many other talking points from today's racing. And there were, as there always are after these big GC battles, there were sort of more details that emerged today about why riders performed the way they did yesterday, or perhaps didn't live up to expectations yesterday. I think a bit more light was shed on Richard Carapaz, mm-hmm. his performance yesterday, am I right?
Yeah, Richard Carapaz yesterday at the finish, he told the media that he was, on one hand, he made too much effort on the approach to the hard section of the climb, the one that was on concrete and double-digit gradients. And on the other hand, he was left without water in the final kilometers, which is something surprising at this time and age of teams deploying feeding points every 20 kilometers. And also taking into account that yesterday's stage, the key point for every team was hydration.
What were the rules on feeding yesterday?
So it was allowed until 5 kilometers to go, which is quite late into the race.
So it was on the steep section. You could have had us when you're at the bottom of the steep section.
You could have had there. The problem is that it was uphill the whole time.
Yeah.
And there were not... And there was not an obvious point on which to feed the riders. And because, you know, when you plan where your feeding points, you have to take into account the route, the priority you give to the different points, and also the fact that riders are not going to take bottles if they are racing full on or at very big speed. So you can't, I mean, it's not effective to plan a feeding point on a flat section. It is deathly dangerous to plan it on a downhill section, and as far as uphill sections were concerned, yesterday in the final 50 kilometers they were all raced full gas because there was a huge fight on the approach to that steep section of the climb. So it was not obvious really to actually plan it and for it to actually happen as it should. Some teams, I mean, like this morning I was talking with Roger Adria from Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. He told me that he had gone back to, he had dropped back to the team car 7 or 8 times yesterday. Yes, because, I assumed that it was just because Bora was aware that there were not those many obvious feeding points. So they just asked the riders to come down as they have done for ages in professional cycling.
In terms of quantity of liquid consumed yesterday, Jack Haig told me this morning that he thought that he'd probably taken on about 10 or 12 bottles yesterday, which actually didn't sound... I was possibly expecting more. That's they're each half a litre, aren't they, the bottles? Presumably they fill them pretty much to the top. So sort of 5 litres, 6 litres.
Yeah. I mean, I am consuming... I am consuming around 4 litres of water per day. So I am surprised that they only take 6.
Yeah. Fran, also yesterday in the podcast, we touched on Dani Martinez's performance. Red Bull, Bora, Hansgrohe, Domestique Deluxe. I suppose he's become a Domestique Deluxe now, having lost 4 minutes yesterday. I saw an interview with him, and I must verify this tomorrow, if I remember. I'll make a note to myself to find out whether this is true. I saw an interview where he said that he had been told that he was coming to the World Tour with very short notice. Maybe, I think the quote that I saw was a week's notice. So that was his sort of reason, excuse for not climbing better yesterday.
I for one, what I can tell you is that I had in mind that Daniel Martinez was coming to the Vuelta even from before the Tour de France, you know. So I don't know. I mean, of course, the politics inside the team are quite different for whatever transpires to the media. So maybe
let's put that one in brackets for now. As I say, as we wait for confirmation. Fran, also yesterday we talked about Sugarman, Carlos Rodriguez, the Ineos Grenadiers leader, who didn't have a great day either. We then had a bit of a conversation yesterday about how well he is suited to the Vuelta a España anyway. This was something that I wanted to expand on, and so I did this morning with his coach, Xabi Arteche, who is the Ineos Grenadiers. He's one of the Ineos Grenadiers coaches. He's also the coach of Egan Bernal. So I asked him about Sugarman's performance yesterday, and also about, well, the point I made, we discussed yesterday, that maybe the Vuelta a España is not his cup of café con leche.
So after the tour, he finished the tour the last week not feeling good, and he went really deep since the last day of the Pyrenees, the second day of the Pyrenees through the end. He went really deep and he finished really tired the Tour de France, and he didn't have in the schedule to do the Vuelta, but during the Tour de France we had a few talks, and we decided to do the Vuelta just to learn for the future, no? We are sure that he is a Grand Tour rider, and in the future he will do 2 Grand Tours in a year, and this process between the Tour de France and the Vuelta is really important to understand how to keep your body composition, how to work on your bike, how important the recovery is. We did the heat training and not altitude training this year in this period. So we are trying to learn how his body responds after a Grand Tour and before the second Grand Tour. Like I said, because he finished really tired and really deep these 3 weeks, the most important thing has been to recover well. So he didn't do too many efforts in the last week, just the last couple of days before coming to the Vuelta. He did a couple of good training days. So probably yesterday it's been a combination of not going deep in a long time, the heat, the first mountain stage, and he felt really good during the day, but obviously, like you could see, he was in this front group, and 3-4 kilometers to the top, he felt empty, and he suffered quite a lot to arrive to the finish, and he tried to minimize the time lost.
Yesterday was a bit of a rampa inhumana, no? That we often see in the Vuelta. The perception is that that's not really his, as we say in English, cup of tea. and yeah. that will limit him maybe in the Vuelta in future, that this is not really his Grand Tour and it's not going to be his Grand Tour in the future. What would you say to that?
I don't know. I'm not also 100% agree. I think, yesterday the stage not being really hard, it was two climbs at the beginning, but after the two climbs the peloton went easy and it's like a monoclimb, no? Just one climb at the end, full gas. And like you said, this is not his cup of tea. He needs like a consecutive climbs and arrive to the finish with more fatigue and probably different kind of climbs. No, not really, really steep, really punchy climbs. But also we saw 2 years ago he did a great Vuelta in his first Grand Tour. So he has to improve in different conditions. And this is also one of the learnings we have to have at the end of the Vuelta, no? And we will try to manage a different situations if we want to have a good Grand Tour rider for the future. And we have seen in different races, like, I don't know, in San Sebastian, in Lombardia, in Strade Bianche, also doing really well. And I think yesterday, in my opinion, he didn't lose time because it wasn't a good race for him. He lost time because he didn't have great legs. And if he should be at his best condition yesterday, like I said, he should be with these seven riders, so at least close, no? Losing 10, 15 seconds, but not 50 seconds.
So, Fran, what did you make of that briefly? What Xavi didn't say there was that the illness that Carlos Rodriguez finished the Tour de France with, or certainly had in the last week, was COVID. And, you know, just thinking about his... Well, as Xavi mentioned there, his previous form, his Vuelta pedigree. Of course, in 2022, he was sixth in the Vuelta, and that was with that nasty crash. Was it on the last day or the penultimate day?
Penultimate day.
Yeah. So, Fran, your thoughts?
I think that it is pretty much what we knew yesterday, that it was a climb that was due to harm those who were not explosive or on top shape, and that it is not representative of what is going to happen in the remainder of the Vuelta.
He's not going to win the Vuelta though, is he?
No, I don't think so.
You quoted someone, an unnamed observer, earlier in the Vuelta, a direct sportif.
Pablo Lastras from Movistar.
Pablo Lastras from Movistar, who predicted that Carlos Rodriguez would win the Vuelta a España. Yeah. And I wonder what Pablo would say now.
But I wonder if even when Pablo said that, he was actually poising him to win the Vuelta, or if he wanted to put some pressure from the Spanish media on Carlos' shoulders instead of on Enrique Mas's.
You're a bad, bad man, Pablo, if that's what you were trying to do. Fran, it is time now for one of our regular features. It is the meeting of the day. Now, in my crosshairs this morning was a rider who is at the Vuelta a España, having thought that a few weeks ago he would be riding the Tour de France. He did not ride the Tour de France. I'm talking about George Bennett, the Israel Premier Tech rider. And he was extremely disappointed not to be selected for the Tour de France, as you're about to hear. He was subsequently sent to Romania, the Sibiu Tour, where I think he finished third on general classification. And he here, Fran, is clearly in excellent form, because yesterday he surprised a lot of people by finishing ninth, Pico Villegas. He is also here, I think, in a sort of mentoring role to Matthew Riccitello as well. And, well, you're about to hear about that disappointment and not being picked for the tour. Also, what he thought of Primoz Roglic yesterday and generally at this Vuelta a España. I think you'll get a bit of a giggle out of what he says about Roglic.
And bear in mind, listeners, that George Bennett is probably winning one of the next few stages.
Interesting. Here is Encuentro del Día.
El Encuentro del Día. The meeting of the day.
George, how satisfying was yesterday?
Oh, it was good. It was nice for us. I mean, to see Richie up there is really good. And, you know, for me it's also good because I normally really suffer on steep climbs, which is strange for being a small guy, but I just can't generate the force on low cadence. So, I was happy to sort of get through that stage. I was dreading it a little bit, but on the other hand, it was also disappointing for Woodsy. You know, I mean, I really think he could have won yesterday. He's been flying now. He's back on form. He's had a rough year, and now he's back. And to have a mechanical, it was tough luck.
And I don't think you had the July that you were hoping for, in the sense, I think you wanted to go to the tour, didn't you? Just tell us, how disappointing was that not to go?
Oh, massively disappointing. Yeah, that was, you know, I built my whole year around the tour, and then felt like, I was really disappointed not to be there. I thought I was in the best shape of the year. I know during that period after Swiss, I really came up a level. I broke every power record of my life, and then I watched the tour from the couch. So that was really frustrating, definitely.
How do you put that disappointment, that frustration aside? I mean, you know, obviously you were back on the bike and back racing. You went to Romania, but how do you overcome something like that?
Oh, you just have to keep going. I mean, it's being an athlete is 90% disappointments. You know, you crash out of a race and you have to get back on. You don't get sick of a race, you've got to keep going to the next one. So it's just, it's your job also, you know. Your job is to train. I enjoy riding my bike. I mean, I'm still disappointed I'm not at the tour. It's not that I don't think about it. It's just I get on with other things, make new goals, and they motivate me a lot, you know. And I straight away put a circle around the Vuelta and said, okay, firstly, I'll try to get selected for this. Secondly, I'll try and be good while I'm here, and that's a motivating goal, and I love the process. I mean, I'm surrounded by great people at home. We train well, we have a great lifestyle, and I really enjoyed the process of getting ready to be here.
In the last 2 or 3 years, do you feel as though you've moved into different sort of phases, kind of mentally, and different roles as well? And we'll just talk about that kind of evolution.
Oh, it hasn't been a progression. It's been a progression. It was a fall off a cliff. It's a recuperation. It's a comeback. It's a whatever, you know. It's not a slow, gradual shift from being a leader to being an experienced guy. It's, you know, I was 2 years in the wilderness doing nothing. I was just shit. So I feel like I'm coming back. I still have ambitions to win races and be a leader. And, you know, whether that's now, it's taken a whole year of having good people on my side, having guys that understand me. Like Sam Bewley is one of my best mates in the whole world, and he's my director. He knows exactly what goes on. He knows when to push, when to not push. And that's a slow process of, like, coming back from the fatigue. He got carried out of UAE you know, just sort of getting back to being where I want to be in races. And, you know, yesterday being at the front of a race again, it's a small step. San Sebastian, I was around the front, a few GC podiums this year. It's a slow process. I'm coming back. Cycling's changed as well. Cycling's got a lot harder. It's not a slow progression at all. It's just, I feel like I went forward really well, I went backwards really far, and now I'm coming forwards again.
I don't want to keep you here for half an hour, but and it's a big topic, but if you had to pick one thing at UAE that didn't really work, you mentioned they're sort of coming out fatigued. What was the one thing that you really didn't kind of click with you?
Oh, race schedule. You know, I love the boys. I had a really good time with a great group of guys. Really enjoyed it from that aspect of it. I worked with good trainers. I had a lot of that, but just not, you know, I was so used to just going altitude targeting a race and not just going from race to race to race, and I think that's what I suffered the most with, probably.
Quick question, George. What do you see in Matthew, the young American kid, yesterday up there? How far do you see him going in GC in this Vuelta?
I think he could go quite far, but I'm hesitant to put any pressure on him. You know, he's young. I think we shouldn't worry too much yet. Just let him do his race, see how he goes. His talent's undeniable. He's and he's learning a lot. He's learning a lot in terms of bunch positioning, downhill, and things like that. And you know, I think it's really early to be like, all right, this guy's on for GC, because, you know, it's his first. I mean, he's done one Giro, but I just don't want to put any pressure on him and say, like, this is now a goal. I think we don't have a goal is a better approach.
and there's potential he could go really, really far, you know. Especially with the course this year, he's great on the steep stuff, he's great on hot stuff. So I think there is potential, but I think we should also just, you know, check the expectations a bit and realize he's still like 20 years old.
For you personally, what is your personal goal out of this welter? A strong GC or a stage win, or what are you looking for?
I think I'm going to assess that on the first rest day after Sunday and say, like, look, if I'm with the best guys, if I'm really in this fight, then let's keep going with the GC. And if I'm not, then pivot, stage hunting, a lot of opportunities in the last 2 weeks. So I think I just need to do a pretty honest assessment with myself on Sunday and realize and see, like, after that stage, are we do I have the level or do I not have the level?
Primoz did Primoz things yesterday.
Yeah, tell everybody shit for the last 2 months and then come out and beat them. But no, it doesn't work anymore. Everyone knows. It's almost like, you know, on Instagram, like when you see a couple posting lots of photos, you know that their relationship's on the rocks. It's like, it's the same version of that. The more he tells you he's bad, the more he's flying. So, I mean, he's got an amazing team around him as well. I think that's also a big asset to him. They've probably got the strongest team in terms of the mountains. But, you know, UAE, also, I think it's going to make a really exciting race because UAE have, actually I say UAE have the strongest team, and UAE have got now 5 guys that are going to start launching early, putting them under pressure. So I think it's going to make the race really hard, having Bora having an early stranglehold and UAE having to attack. So.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
La Vuelta Sartorial. The Sartorial Vuelta.
So, Fran, this is the Vuelta Sartorial, the Sartorial Vuelta, in which we dig out and stitch critique clothing artifacts of Vuelta España's of yesteryear. Today, Fran, Euskaltel have been very prominent in this Vuelta España with their orange jersey. We're going to talk about another orange jersey. This is Gustave Delors' orange jersey in 1935, the very first edition of the Vuelta. Fran, tell the listeners what it looks like. Orange. It's orange.
Orange. Well, it is a black and white picture, so I can't really see how orange it is. But I am going to imagine that it is an Euskaltel-like orange.
There you go. So, listeners, if you did not know this already, yes, the Vuelta a España's first leader's jersey was orange. But the intriguing thing about this is that there is no one who seems to know why. And the best we have are clues. There are certain clues that sort of hint as to why it might have been orange. In the official rule book of that first Vuelta, As the Oficina Permanente has been unpacked around us, and we're going to have to move in a second. There are clues. In the official rule book, the reference was made to the fact that the Vuelta a Levante, a race that was going on, well, used to take place at that time, they had a red leader's jersey. Catalunya, Volta a Catalunya was green, the Tour de France was yellow, and there was pink in the Giro d'Italia. We sort of suggest that the Vuelta had gone for orange simply to try and differentiate their race. Gustave Delors was the winner of that first edition of the Vuelta a España in 1935. He also won the Vuelta in 1936 when it was again orange. However, in the 35 Vuelta, he didn't wear it on the state of Valencia. He was fined 50 pesetas as a result. Why didn't he wear it? He said he'd got dirty the day before, very dirty, and hence he had decided not to. Interestingly, also in the regulations of that 1935 Vuelta France, it specified that the one jersey that took precedence over the orange jersey was the Spanish national champion's jersey. Now, if the same rider was to hold the Spanish national champion's jersey and the orange jersey of Vuelta leader, they were allowed to wear an orange cap or an orange bracelet, which I thought was rather nice. You've got some bracelets on at the moment.
Yeah, yellow and black. And you know, when you say that he didn't wear it because it was too dirty, there is a rider who was leader of the Vuelta in this century for 10 days and who did not wash his gold jersey and used the same one for every day.
Go on.
I'm not going to tell you because this is a secret that they shared with me, but it it made waves in the peloton. No one wanted to stay near him.
I think I know who you mean. I'll tease that out of you. As I said, he also won the 1936 Vuelta. He retired, therefore, he retired a few years later with a perfect record of having ridden and won two Vueltas a España. The only other Grand Tour he did was the Tour de France. Eddy Merckx also has a perfect record in the Vuelta a España. Played one, won one. Orange returned for a single edition in 1942 and again for a single edition in 1977 because the sponsor was Butano.
You know what Butano is?
Gas.
Yeah, it is the gas, and you know that this gas comes in some orange containers that are about half a meter tall. You know what I mean? Maybe you can explain it in English so the people can actually figure out what that is. The orange container, the very heavy and such.
Yeah.
So gas canisters. Yeah. So back in the time of the radio wars in the Vuelta, when the Spanish radios were fighting for audience, one of the main players in that war, José María García, he was short and stocky, and because of this Butano jersey, he was nicknamed Butano for the rest of his career.
Very good. So, Fran, that was the orange jersey, which, you know, for a few years, sort of intermittently in the course of what the history was, the leaders, it was the colour that denoted leadership of the Vuelta a España. Incidentally, Gustave Delors' biography was written by a colleague and good friend of ours, Juan Fran de la Cruz, who is from Extremadura, where we started from today. And De la Vuelta a la Luna, from the Vuelta to the Moon. Why was it called that? Because Gustave Delors ended up working on the development of Apollo 11 at Cape Canaveral. He went into sort of aerospace engineering. Again, a fascinating book, that, De la Vuelta a la Luna. And that was the Vuelta Sartorial. Before that, Fran, we heard George Bennett suggest that Primoz Roglic's sandbagging reminded him of couples who overshare on Instagram and who are probably on the rocks. That is my nomination for quote of the Vuelta a España so far. But Fran, it's time for us to talk about the next Andalusian stage. It will come tomorrow. It's stage 6. It's time for La Etapa de Mañana y La Cena de Ayer.
La Etapa de Mañana, La Cena de Ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Last night's dinner, Fran, was remarkable mainly because it was extremely late. A lot of driving yesterday, 2 hours after the stage to get to Merida. The most noteworthy dish I had when we did finally find a restaurant, and a fine restaurant it was gazpacho de cerezas. Gazpacho of cherries. And not only cherries, tomatoes, sort of traditional gazpacho that people might be familiar with, tomato soup, but it has cherries added. This is quite well known, isn't it? In, I don't know if it's, it's not specific to Extremadura, is it?
It's in every region of Spain, there you can find different variations of gazpacho. Yeah. In the case of Extremadura, they have the Jerte Valley, on which the cherries are very, very renowned. I mean, they are not only a food attraction and a food product to export, it's also a touristic attraction. So whenever the cherry trees come to when those cherry trees bloom for a couple of weeks, this region is flooded with visitors that want to see the valley on its majesty.
Yeah. Very nicely put, Fran. Very beautifully put. Fran, tell us about tomorrow's stage. I feel slightly culpable that we're not hearing from the Lynx of Marbella now, Luis Ángel Mate, because it's kind of the, well, la etapa del Lince, the Lynx stage tomorrow. I didn't manage to catch up with him this morning, so you're going to have to present the stage as well, the baby Lynx.
The baby Lynx. Okay. After Carter Reyes comes baby Lynx. Yeah, okay, that's good.
Maybe baby Lynx.
So tomorrow we are starting from the Carrefour supermarket, which is quite an interesting feature that might as well become a fixture. I was talking with the technical director of the Vuelta, Kiko García, yesterday, and he told me that to him this is a show of respect towards the sponsor. He was downplayed the thing on sporting terms. After all, it is only going to be a few meters on the neutralized zone that is going to be rolling through the supermarket.
Any climbs in there? Any bonus sprints in the Carrefour?
No, maybe riders will love to stop by the fridges to steal some Calippo shots.
I posted a picture earlier on our social media of Marc Soler enjoying a Calippo. I must say, he wasn't the only rider enjoying a Calippo, but it was very on brand for Marc Soler to be enjoying a Calippo. Quite a lot of people replied that he should really have been enjoying a Solero, but that would not be on brand for Marc Soler, because Marc Soler is a bit of he's a maverick, he's a bit of a contrarian, you could say. He does the unexpected. So I was very happy to see him clutching one of those just moments before the start today.
Yeah, he introduced this feature in the UAE team last year at Tour de France, and now it's been adopted by many, many teams. In fact, in the warm-up of the ITT, I was near some team bus, and they opened a portable fridge full of Calippos.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, and the Kiko García also pointed out that riders would be happy to start inside the supermarket because of the air conditioning. But jokes aside, the serious part of the stage starts 60 kilometers into the race, 60 kilometers out of the total of 185.5, with a series of climbs that are very renowned in Spain because of how hard they are, because they are very long, very irregular. This doesn't translate into the profile, as most of them are just pictured as a straight line, but the Puerto del Boyar, the Puerto del Viento, el Alto de las Abejas, who are some of the climbs that will be featured tomorrow, are great training, make for great training rides. Indeed, the ONCE team, back in the day when nobody held winter training camps, they had one every January for 10 days or so in this very region of Spain, specifically from the Hotel Las Truchas in the village of El Bosque, through which we are passing. So
one day we'll do a feature on the cycling podcast of the most famous hotels in professional cycling history. There are a lot of them. In fact, I think we might have even touched on this subject with Brian Nigot at the Giro, when we went in search of the Hotel Excelsior, I think it was called, where Eddie Merckx he was holed up when he tested positive in 1969. Giro, this led to a conversation about what was the most iconic hotel in Grand Tour in cycling history. There are lots that you could mention. The Hotel Touring in Madonna di Campiglio, infamous for Marco Pantani being kicked out in 1999 Giro. Hotel El Capitan at the bottom of the Lagos de Covadonga, where Miguel Indurain abandoned the Vuelta a España and abandoned his career effectively. So anyway,
So back to the stage. One category first climb, which is Puerto El Boyar at kilometer 73.4. If the breakaway is not established by that time, it will be a carnage. But since the breakaway is going to be well gone, it's not going to be that hard. Then we have two categories, two Cat 3 climbs, Puerto del Viento at kilometer 130 and Puerto Martinez at kilometer 160. And with 10 kilometers to go, we start the climb to this irregular Puerto de las Abejas, the beehive climb.
Could be a good omen for Visma Lisa bike.
Maybe. Why not? Why not having Dylan Van Baarle? Well, Dylan Van Baarle is probably not the best choice, but Steven Kreis bike attacking there. Why not? And it leads all the way to Junquera, a pretty small village in the very heart of Andalusia, because this region we are going through is the actual center, geographical center of Andalusia. We are going close to, we are passing around Ronda, which is indeed the geographical center of Andalusia, and we head later into the Sierra de las Nieves, a very not too well known demarcation. The Sierra de Grazalema, which is the one that we passed before Ronda, is a bit more well known in Spain because, very counterintuitively, is the region in Spain where it rains the most over the year.
Oh, wow.
With the highest pluviometry. You would expect that to be in Galicia, right?
Yeah.
But no, it is there in Grazalema because of the concurrence of factors. And the other side of the Sierra de las Nieves is Sierra Bermeja. Sierra Bermeja, it suffered a huge fire 4 or 5 years ago. And one of the persons who came to help, who donated a decent amount of money for it to be repopulated, was our dear Lynx, Luis Ángel Maté.
We will definitely feature on tomorrow's podcast. We'll go into more detail about this tomorrow, I hope. Fran, we should probably leave it more or less there. However, I did want to mention, well, I already talked, I think, earlier in the Vuelta about the fact I've been invited by Carrefour. I've got some kind of VIP pass for the start tomorrow. I don't know whether I'll exploit that to its full effect, but yeah, we will be as close as we can get to the Carrefour, to the tills at the Carrefour supermarket tomorrow. I also know that something is cooking at Lidl Trek. There's some kind of counter guerrilla marketing coup that is being cooked up by Lidl Trek. Of course, they are rivals to Carrefour and the Lidl supermarket chain. And we should also be prepared for the eventuality of all of the Lidl Trek riders being sacked tomorrow, because I believe in their contracts it states that they're not allowed to enter other supermarkets in team clothing, and they might have to tomorrow. They might have to go in team kit. So yeah, they might all be out of the race tomorrow night. But yeah, I've got an idea what they're going to try and do, Lidl, tomorrow. It might be quite controversial, depending on whether they go for the sort of the nuclear approach or the, well, you talked about diplomacy earlier, the softer diplomacy, shall we say.
You know, what I would like to happen is that they get fired before the stage and they just race in plain clothing and become the isolé of this race. You know, do you remember that time in the Tour de France on which individual riders could enter the race and they were called the isolated riders? I would love for Theo Gegenhardt, Matthias Kielmose, Giulio Ciccone just taking their feet and their assistance from the neutral car and doing their own race to turn it upside down. Wouldn't that be nice?
That's all coming tomorrow. We'll wait and see, shall we? Fran, thank you very much.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks, dear listeners. See you tomorrow.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Fall is all about cozy comforts, and with Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your favorites and still hit your health goals. From breakfast bagels and meal-prepped enchiladas to mouth-watering burgers and cheesy noodles. You won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at hero.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.